This podcast is brought to you by Shopify. Shopify is growing their team with offices and remote teams across the globe. Visit shopify.com/careers to learn more.
Do you know what the best thing about Booleans is?
I'm afraid to ask yes or say yes.
Even when you're wrong, you're just a bit off.
Oh, God. Okay, there we go.
Hi, Sean.
Hi, Sam. So I decided that you are right about not wrapping background jobs in a transaction implicitly.
Yeah.
For crates.io.
I agree.
And it turns out that, well, so this is all right specifically for right now, just a single thing we want to make asynchronous, which is updating the,
right.
the Git index, which doesn't even need a database connection in the first place.
Right.
And it turns out that if I don't try and share a database connection between the job runner and the job being run, the entire implementation is way simpler because I don't have to like worry about my transaction getting polluted. And so I have to mark the job as failed in like a separate transaction.
Totally. And I mean, having reflected on that, I think that's also the right implementation and why Sidekick does it. So I'm glad we came to consensus on a thing from one of our earlier episodes.
Yes. I just wanted to update you on that because I've been finishing up the implementation.
Nice.
So, Sam, what have you been working on this week?
So I have descended into maximum manager mode over the past week because as we go into Q4, DigitalOcean is doing a talent development and talent planning cycle, which means so I have three engineers who report into me, which means I'm sort of assessing how they've been doing over the past two quarters, writing development plans for them, thinking about promotion cycles, performance reviews, and all of that good stuff. And so it's been like a really interesting week because we've only just begun that. And I've been working with one of our internal talent development folks to begin to level set, especially against the rest of engineering in DigitalOcean, about how my folks are doing against the general background, which has been really exciting for me because I really like the people that I work with. And so thinking about their development and growth is always really enjoyable for me.
Nice.
Yeah. And so basically the way that it works at DO is that every 6 months we do one of these cycles. So one happens in Q2 and one happens in Q4. And there's like a bunch of different activities that we do. So firstly, everyone in the company gets at least up-down feedback. So you have to write feedback for your manager, and your manager writes feedback for you. And that takes the form. It's fairly nice. It's one thing that the person is having that's high impact at DigitalOcean, one thing the person could be doing to have more impact at DigitalOcean, and sort of any other questions or general feedback. And the nice thing about that is that because it's like a one thing, it tends to be fairly easy to fill out something for that for nearly everyone without like having to really think too hard. Mm-hmm. And it's like a very quick thing, but it tends to work fairly well. And then basically every other cycle, so once a year, everyone at DigitalOcean gets a 360 feedback where they have to select three peers that they've worked with to do the same thing, right? And so I have some of my folks who are getting 360s and some of my folks who are just getting up-down feedback. But so I've kind of been in a mode of thinking about like what makes for good feedback. How do we make sure that that's actually developmental as opposed to just like, you're doing a great job, well done everyone, like pats on the back and that sort of thing. And so that's been really enjoyable, working with people to select their peers so that it's not just like totally easy, because with some people, you know, like the result's just going to be this person is great and moving on swiftly, especially because I see engineers and not necessarily thinking about the people that they're working with and the peer feedback that they should be giving every day, right? And it's very easy to fall into that trap. And so also coaching people on how to give feedback well is something I've been thinking about a fair bit recently.
Sure.
But yeah, so that's been good.
I mean, I'm not a manager and I'm not great at giving feedback to people, so I'm not sure that I have a lot to add on that cycle, other than, yes, I have also received feedback and sometimes tried to give it, but the giving, it's never gone terribly well for me.
That's really understandable. And in fact, I would say that, like, of all the people who struggle in this the most, I do generally find it's IC engineers, because they are spending so much of their time thinking about code and systems and architecture and project planning and whatever else it may be.
What's an IC engineer?
Individual contributor engineer. That just means someone who sits down and writes code all day, okay, as opposed to what I do, which is decidedly the opposite of that. For our audience at home, as I'm sure they can tell, I actually probably only spend about 20-30% of my time writing software anymore, and spend the rest of it doing stuff like this, or project planning, or working with technology leads across the organization on different things. But actually, writing software is becoming a diminishing component of my job right now, for sure. And so, because I'm more people-focused in my role right now than perhaps many others, this is something that comes quite naturally to me. But as you've indicated, this is not a thing that necessarily comes naturally to most engineers. And so, one of the things that I really try to impress on people is that, like, it should be actionable, and it should be kind, right? And right. so something actionable is not like you're doing a great job, but it might be like, when you review my pull requests, you always ask things in the forms of questions and not statements that tell me how to do my job, and I really appreciate it, so please continue to do that, right? And there, the point of that sort of constructive positive feedback is to promote the behaviors that are really impactful to the company, right? So, like, when someone gives you a really great code review, I'm sure you've noticed and, like, really enjoyed that feeling, right? And so telling them that, like, that is making them more pleasant to work with is a really good form of feedback to give. You'll notice that we ask our question in the form of, what could this person do to have more impact, rather than, like, what is this person bad at, right?
Right.
Because there's no way to answer a sort of, like, sad version of that question without being an asshole. And so that question is very deliberately designed to encourage good feedback behavior, right, in the person who's giving the feedback. And so there, for example, you generally want something of the form of, like, something that if this person were to do more of or is not doing today would, like, significantly help them develop as an engineer. So, for example, like, it might be better if this person wrote more unit tests when working in Go, right? Like, that's something we could do that's, like, fairly technical, but it could go all the way up to, you know, I feel like this person is a really good engineer, but they don't spend much time contributing to architectural discussions on the team, and I'd really enjoy it if they did that, right? And so it's generally aimed at, like, we think you are smart. There are ways that you could contribute that you are not currently, and it would be great if you did that. And so again, right, that's actionable and specific, but it's being kind rather than being like, you are terrible at your job and you should stop doing it, right? Yeah. Because most people we work with aren't trying to do their jobs badly, right? They really do care. And so for me, it's a function of working out if someone is not doing something that could bring them to the sort of, like, best performance levels that they can be at, why is that happening, right? And as a manager, when I'm sort of aggregating feedback, both the ones that I've given and ones that come from peers, I sort of look for trends, but I also want to couch it in terms of, like, we think you're great and here are some ways in which you could be more great, because I don't work with any people that, like, I don't think are good at their jobs, right? All of the people who report to me, I think, are excellent performers. And so really it's a function of helping them improve and develop their career and that sort of thing, rather than, like, this is a performance review, you are a bad person at your job and we are trying to fire you, right? Yeah. Like, that, like, if we get to that situation in a 6-month performance cycle, it means that something has gone horribly, horribly wrong, because I haven't been able to help that person correct for their behavior in the meantime, right? And I'm a really big proponent of sort of continuous feedback cycles. I don't, like, there's a thing some managers like to do where they save up all the feedback for a week into someone's one-on-one. And I really don't like that, because it makes the person who's reporting to you dread their one-on-one, right? It's like, oh no, Sam's going to hit me with a mountain of negative stuff. And I'm just like, I would much rather give someone feedback immediately when something like that happens, rather than make them dread that. And
absolutely.
So, yeah.
This is one of the things that I've always missed in open source, is that there's not nearly as many opportunities to get feedback from the people that you work with all the time.
Right, exactly. And well, there's no one who runs talent development on your open source project.
Right. Which maybe is part of why we have such a hard time finding enough contributors, but
right. That's actually a really interesting thought, is that like a lot of these structures exist, right, to keep people engaged and make them be successful on what they're doing, right? So the reason I take weekly one-on-ones with all of the engineers who report to me is like, it's not just for giggles, right? I have specific objectives going into that meeting. One is to make sure that person is engaged, happy, that there's nothing that I need to do in the wider organization to make their blockers or problems go away. And the other one is to help them focus on their career development, because that's one of the things that will keep people around, right? Is giving them opportunities to grow and succeed. And that structure or that idea is mirrored in nearly every engineering organization of size, right? Like, they all do something like this for talent engagement and growth reasons. But like, if you look at your favorite open source project, or say either of the ones that you and I contribute to, that's completely missing. Like, that does not exist at all. And neither does any kind of real feedback cycle, right? Like, I guess you could sort of make the argument that in Rails, you transition from documentation commit bit to full commit bit to having access to the Rails Twitter account. But
the problem is, if that doesn't happen, you don't get feedback as to why it's not happening.
Right. But it's also not feedback, right? It's just like, congratulations, we trust you more now, with no real input as to why. And additionally, like, your peers like don't really have an opportunity to talk to you about how you're doing in a like candid way. And so like, I actually think you're kind of onto something there, is that if you want to make new contributors sticky, that's like a way that I could imagine would really, really help. And it's not something that we're actually very good at right now.
Right.
But like, sorry, just to continue riffing there, it's very strange to me. Like, open source is a very strange thing, actually, right? Like, I've always been like, it's really weird that we get together and write code in our spare time and give it to people, and like, we wouldn't ever do that at all in our jobs, right? And so it's kind of natural to me that some of those structures are missing, but like, I do think that like, you would find that contributors are materially more engaged if you did set some of those structures up. And it would be really interesting to see what an open source project like run like a real engineering organization might look like.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so I mean, it'd be interesting to see that happen on a project like RSpec, which, speaking of, do you want to, you haven't mentioned the big news yet.
Oh yeah, I guess that happened. So I guess this is a weird place to insert it, but we'll insert it anyway. So for any RSpec fans in the audience, Myron Marston, who was the lead maintainer of RSpec for, well, since I joined the project, really, has stepped down as lead maintainer. And myself and a man named John Rowe have been promoted, quote unquote, I don't really know if it's a promotion, to lead maintainers. Specifically, I'm probably going to be driving the RSpec Rails project, which is really where I've been committing and actually managing the releases for the last couple of years. And then John will be taking over the rest of the RSpec gems. For those of you not familiar, RSpec is not a monolithic gem, but it's sort of a constellation of libraries that happen to work with each other. And it also happens to be the most downloaded Ruby gem of all time by like a lot. Like, if you look at the rubygems.org stats, the first five gems are RSpec and its one dependency, which is diff-lcs, right? They're all RSpec gems apart from diff-lcs. So yeah, that's a cool transition that's happened. I mean, we have some plans, but largely there's no real change that's going to happen here, right? It's business.
Well, you're
as
in
usual.
A position now, right, where if you wanted to start implementing these feedback cycles that we've been talking about, you're now in a position where you could make that happen on that project.
Yeah, I don't know that I would necessarily feel equipped to do that in a way that makes any sense. Like, I don't know that it's actually like, I think it's an interesting idea, but I don't know how I actually feel about, say, doing up down feedbacks and performance reviews every 6 months with other contributors, or like whether that even makes sense. Right?
No, because, I mean, maybe it's a different structure than that.
Yeah, absolutely. That might be an interesting conversation for me to have with John when we get together later in the month to have a chat about all things RSpec.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll let you know if anything comes out of that for sure.
Yeah, I should think about doing that for Diesel too, because that's sort of like some of our stickiest contributors have been contributors who come in through the Increasing Rust Reach program, which basically does lead to that sort of, maybe not explicitly framed as feedback, but just, you know, basically weekly one-on-ones and making sure that everybody has stuff to do and is getting help if they need it.
That's a really good model. But so, correct me if I'm wrong here, but the way the Rust Reach program works is that you get like an assigned mentor and like that person is helping you. And so is it the case that like existing Diesel core team members became mentors of these people, or is it like random people who happened to be excited about Rust volunteered to mentor someone through contributing to Diesel, even if they'd never done so before themselves?
No, so I was the mentor. And so basically, like, you submit projects that you would like to be a part of the program. And as part of that, you sign up to be the mentor of whoever. Most projects take one person. I usually take two. I encourage the Diesel core team, I encourage questions to get asked in the Diesel contributors room rather than directly addressed to me, and I encourage the rest of the core team to get involved, but ultimately I end up being the person responsible for mentoring them during the program.
Gotcha. And so there's a little bit of a scalability limit in there, because you can't really mentor more than two people without like completely burning out, I would imagine, right?
I mean, it's just a question of how much time I spend writing code, right? I have a limited amount of time to work on the project in any capacity. So sure. If I spend I can spend less time writing code and more time mentoring. But yeah, my hope would be if we started doing something like this more formally, that the entire core team would get involved.
Right. And then you might find that your first time mentees become mentors in the next cycle, right?
Yeah,
and that,
absolutely.
That then you can have a scaling effect through that, which I think is really cool, actually. It's the sort of thing where, like, if I was a little bit more organized and I had a little bit more time to work on RSpec, I would totally be looking for, like, Summer of Code contributors or something else. Because, like, we could definitely do with staffing up one or two, like, more regular contributors, especially on RSpec Rails, which I will happily admit the issue backlog has gotten a little bit out of hand on, for sure. So one of the other things that I've had to do as part of this is start writing development plans for everyone who reports to me. And a development plan is basically at DigitalOcean, a document that your manager has to file at a cycle in order for you to be eligible for promotion at the next cycle. So we sort of assume that we've mostly got people leveled correctly, and so that you would see a promotion coming, right? There are obviously exceptional circumstances to that, but for the most part, that's how that works. And one of the things that I think is really interesting is with some of the more senior engineers that report to me, like how varied the like paths they want to take their career down are, right? So some engineers are really interested in just sort of being at the keyboard, smashing out code all day. They don't really want to go to meetings. They are interested in like learning certain technologies deeper and being architects and that sort of thing. And so the development plan document that I would write for someone like that looks completely different to someone who's like, I want to be a technology lead and maybe eventually a manager someday. And I'm
right.
Like, I have to, what's funny is like, I've picked my own position in this path, but I have to be able to understand the mentality of like all of those different paths and what's like going to be good for a person in that position, even if they might have more skill than me down a particular technology or you know, area of interest, right?
Right.
And so that's actually one of the things that I think is most interesting about the position I'm in right now, is that I have to measure the impact of someone who might be more knowledgeable than me about the things that we're measuring their impact for, and then work out how they could have more impact, even if like I don't really understand much about the technology area that they're in. And then I have to write coaching guidelines for that person and then work out how to coach them. And so one of the things that I've taken to a lot is just asking lots and lots of questions about a person's interest and like helping them explore areas where like their explanations don't necessarily make sense, as a way of helping them develop skills in any particular technology area. But it's like, it's super fascinating to not only have my own career ambitions, but now to be able to watch others have career ambitions and try to predict what will be helpful for them.
One thing that I've heard less recently, but that I've heard historically, is people who think that just going into management or like, or, you know, becoming a manager or a CTO or a VP of technology or engineering or whatever is like the natural career path.
Yeah.
When it's a completely different set of skills to be an effective manager versus an effective programmer.
Right. No, absolutely. And so actually at DigitalOcean, the engineering career path is designed such that there is equal depth in the management and IC tracks. So we have IC1, which is kind of like our entry-level to mid-level engineer. IC2, which would be the equivalent of a senior engineer at many companies, but we reserve as an engineer 2 largely because DigitalOcean's architecture is complex and weird, and we are a technology company. So we sort of like reserve senior to mean like really accomplished technologist. So there's senior engineer 1, which is IC3, senior engineer 2, which is IC4, and then staff and principal. And IC3 is equivalent to manager 3, which is the first management level, the DigitalOcean. IC4, senior engineer 2, is equivalent to senior manager. IC5, staff engineer, is equivalent to director. And IC6 is equivalent to VP, right?
Is there anybody who's actually at IC6?
There are currently no IC6 engineers, but we only have one VP of engineering, so like one could easily imagine that might happen. And there are a few people who I might guess would get that promotion, maybe not this cycle, but at the next one for sure.
Okay.
But we do have a bunch of staff engineers who are sort of equivalent to director level in their expectations and performance and comp and all of that stuff, right?
Right.
And so it's like it actually is a pretty well paralyzed ladder. The theory is that you can switch back and forth at various levels, but I think realistically at the director and VP level, that's unlikely to ever happen.
It might cause some organizational problems if anybody tried.
Right. So I will say that there are senior engineer 2s at DigitalOcean who do have a bunch of management experience, and so it wouldn't be surprising at all to me if they switched back into a management career track at any point. There's maybe one person total who I think could switch between director and staff engineer in the company, right? But like, it's by those points, right? Especially director and VP, your expectation is that you can coach people who can coach people who can coach people,
right?
And manage budgets and design effective business units and that sort of thing. And so it's almost as hard a technical problem, frankly, as building some of the software that we work in, right? Designing good software organizations is itself a very hard technical skill.
Yes.
Right? And you know, Conway's law basically says that your organization reflects the structure of your software anyway.
Right.
And so like, I think people vastly underestimate just how technical good technical leadership can be, which is why, like, also I'm sort of still running straight down the middle, right? I sort of wear both a management and technology lead hat, and I'm still, while I may not be writing software, I'm certainly still writing individualized Jira cards about like, please do exactly these things in order to solve this problem, right?
Sure.
And so more of an architect maybe than a programmer anymore, but certainly not the kind that designs UML, lobs it over a wall and expects stuff to get done.
Oh gosh, let's not get into UML. Before we want to run out of time, I actually want to pivot that. I had one other thing I wanted to talk about that I thought was pretty interesting this last week.
Sure.
So on Crace.io, one of the things that I'm working on or worked on this last week is getting some of those metrics in place of like, hey, page me if this metric has been exceeded.
Cool.
The three that I know for sure we want are number of jobs in the background queue, a job that has failed greater than n times, and then if we've gone n minutes without a crate being uploaded. That one we discussed, I think, in episode 1, or maybe it was in one of the episodes we discussed it, and I talked about how like it seems like we pretty consistently get a crate uploaded every 5 minutes, and I'll bet there's a time span that we can avoid false positives. That time span makes the metric useless. It has to be 4 hours. And we've never had a case where crate uploads were broken for 4 hours without it getting reported through other channels and fixed. But it's still non-zero value, but closer to zero.
I would recommend to you something that I recommended in that earlier episode, which is to have a bot which just uploads a crate.
Yeah, that's what we're going to do eventually. Yeah. But this is just a thing I need otherwise.
Yeah, because like, exactly. And I will also point out to you that error is going to be flappy for all sorts of reasons that are wildly out of your control.
Yes.
So like, for example, one of the most extreme cases that I could possibly give you is, you know, like when someone screws up their DNS sufficiently badly that like the whole internet starts routing traffic to the wrong country. You probably don't need to status page for that, but like that could well break your metric, right?
Right. No, and that's why, you know, we'll have to play around with it to make sure we don't get a ton of false positives. But
Yeah. So when you're doing a like I expect event Y to happen every X, the best thing to do is write something yourself that makes sure that event Y is gonna happen every X anyway, right?
Yes. And again, and that is a thing that I'm planning on doing. It's just this is a thing I need anyway, so I'm still building it. So, but the interesting part was less that metric and more, so I need to integrate with the PagerDuty API. I looked at the crates. One of them appears unmaintained, and the other one has docs that don't build. So I only need to hit one endpoint. So I'm like, all right, whatever. What's the HTTP library that we're using right now? And I'll just use that. And we're using libcurl. So after finishing the feature, the next thing I did was went in and replaced all uses of libcurl with a more rusty high level HTTP client called request. Ran into some fun. We have basically our own little VCR-ish thing, and so learned some fun differences in the exact request headers that we were sending. And this is some of these I found just very interesting. So one of the ones that we no longer send is proxy connection keep alive, which the only documentation I can find on it at all is a Wikipedia article that says that it exists as a misinterpretation of the HTTP spec by early implementations, and either has no effect on most servers or is treated the same as the connection header. And we very much do not want connection keep alive here. And Firefox has removed it. Recent versions of libcurl don't send it anymore, so that one was safe to remove. The other one that was really fun was curl was sending for put requests expect 100 continue, which the person who wrote our VCR-ish thing didn't understand what that was supposed to do, and so actually then, you know, went into curl to try and like override that behavior, which worked some of the time. And expect is just one of my favorite little dark corners of the HTTP spec, because it's a header. And it says the only specified value is 100 continue, but the spec doesn't say that it has to have that value. That's just the only one that anybody is supposed to care about. And basically what it means is you send your request headers only, but no request body. And then you're supposed to get 100 continue status, maybe with response headers, but I don't think you get response headers actually. You just get 100 continue. And you wait to see that until you send your request body. And so it's for things like large uploads where, this was back in a time where sending an upload was incredibly expensive, really at any size. So the idea being the server tells you if it would accept your request based on the headers before it sees the body.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And, you know, there's very little reason to be doing it these days unless you're sending an incredibly massive request body. In our case, we actually expect the request to always get accepted anyway. But then my favorite thing about the specification for this is that it was added in 1.1, not 1.0. So not all servers are going to recognize it. So you can't actually like send this. And then the spec even says you should not wait an indefinite period of time before sending the response body. You just have to sit there and wait and see if it recognizes it and see if it acknowledges it. And if it doesn't after some period of time, just upload the request body anyway.
And you're doing this for a put to Amazon.
Yes,
right?
Correct.
And so does Amazon like play nicely with this behavior?
Yes.
Cool.
Yeah. Most servers should. It's a legacy thing that if our files were larger, it might be reasonable to do. Except we never expect these. There's no precondition that should ever fail here.
Right. And I mean, this is bandwidth from your server to Amazon, right? So like your file would have to be stupendously large for it actually to be a problem, because you're like, well, you're on Heroku, so you're literally inside Amazon's data center, right? So you're doing a transfer entirely within their network.
Well, and eventually I want to have our server stop being a middleman for this anyway.
Right. No, and we've talked about that before. But yeah, no, that's kind of hilarious. And I mean, really, once you defer that to the whoever's, you know, being a client to crates.io, you know, they can do whatever they want, right? Yeah. It might not be cargo. It will probably be cargo, but it might not be cargo, right? And so, yeah, that's like a... That's a really interesting HTTP edge case behavior.
Yeah. And, you know, cargo definitely might want to do the 100 continue stuff, and that's all well and good.
Right.
There were some other interesting, like, quirks and curls behavior, though. So, like, for example, it doesn't send a user agent by default. Curl the command line does, I believe, but libcurl does not send a user agent by default. But there are some servers that will rightfully reject your request if you don't include a user agent. So we were setting the user agent string of hello, which just, no.
I've been there.
The other one that I find really interesting, curl doesn't send an accept encoding header by default. But if it gets if it gets a gzipped response, it will absolutely un-gzip it for you by default.
I could believe that.
So
But only if the web server specifies that it encoded the response with gzip.
No,
right?
as it should. But what I mean is that like it absolutely will accept a gzip encoded response, but it doesn't tell the server that by default. And so a lot of servers will send you un-gzipped responses.
Yeah, well, so I mean, if you don't include an accept encoding header, the server is free to do whatever it wants. Actually,
it is free to do whatever it wants, but a lot of them will just assume that you don't know how to deal with any encoding.
Sure. Well, but actually many, and I've encountered this as well, will just always return gzips.
Yes.
Especially for static files. So like many things behind Varnish or Cloudflare, like it doesn't matter what encoding header you send to them. Even if you say, I don't accept gzip, they will just return to you a gzipped response body when they should in fact send you not acceptable if they're going to do that. Which is my favorite HTTP response code of all time, is this is not acceptable. How dare you send me this request?
Yeah,
that's really fun. I always enjoy having adventures in HTTP land and really, really messing with headers to get stuff right.
Yeah, well, and this wasn't like I didn't even really have to mess with anything. It was more a lot of our headers were getting set manually, and I needed to either continue to set them manually with the new library or decide if we didn't need to set them. Like there were some really funky things coming from our use of libcurl. Like we were manually setting the host header, which at best is useless, and at worst is an incredibly terrible latent bug, because the host header is just the address of the server that you sent the request to.
Well, right, but when you have virtual hosted servers, it's extremely important, right?
So actually, it has to be set. Like the request can't get processed otherwise, which is why your library sets it for you when you tell it send a request to this URL.
I actually think if you're manually, so I don't know what the Rust libcurl extension is doing, but I actually believe if you're manually calling libcurl, they leave the onus on you to set it.
No,
Really?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
I'm 100% positive. Because literally, they have it. If you have an API that is, here's a URL, please send a request to there, an HTTP request there, and it doesn't set the host header, your request won't get processed. Like, the host header is required header for all requests.
Interesting. I think I've definitely worked with libraries that do not do that. In fact, I think I think I have four commits in the Ruby HTTP library, and I think one of them was setting the host
header. No, there's no way.
No, before I promise you this, because this is one of my commits in the Ruby HTTP, not net HTTP. I'm talking about the gem HTTP.
Okay.
And this was maybe 5 or 6 years ago. It did not set the host header when you made it send a request. Instead, it just did like it just fired the request without that header, and it did not work.
Right.
It was passing all of their tests because their tests had it like hit a locally spun up like rack server that would just respond to anything that looked vaguely like an HTTP request, right? But it didn't actually work. And so I promise you, this is one of the very, in fact, I think this might be the first ever open source Ruby pull request I did.
Oh gosh.
Is like make the HTTP gem actually work.
That is horrifying.
And I think at one point in time, I was the number four all-time contributor to that library. I hope that's not the case anymore, but it was, I mean, this was early days before Faraday was really a thing, actually. Like, even at this point in time, Faraday was not popular. Net HTTP, you know, is not the most pleasant of libraries to work with in Ruby. And so I was like, oh, this HTTP gem looks legit. Oh, I'm going to send a request to example.com. Oh, it didn't work. Oh, it's because it's not setting the host header. Oh, well, I guess I know what I'm going to do today.
The other fun one that we were doing was we were setting the date header, which per the HTTP spec, like the date header is for responses. It can be included in a request, but it should not be included in requests which contain no request body. And even if it does, this header is optional. I'm assuming we were setting it because Amazon does require you to set it in your requests because the auth key that you generate is a signed hash of a nonce, the date, an MD5, the content body, I think, and your auth token. So it needs the date that you used, the exact date you used for that to you know, verify your signature.
And you also have to like alphabetically sort the parameters and then hash all of those as well, if I recall.
I don't remember. I just remember that the date's included in it.
They may have changed this, but that certainly at one point you had to sort your parameters alphabetically and then hash them as well. Yeah.
But yeah, so we needed to set the date header there. And I'm assuming that was the first usage of libcurl in the application that got written. And so then all the other places that were setting the date header and also the host header were because they copy pasted this code to start as a starting point.
And so it fanned out to everywhere in the application. Yeah. Oh, that's really funny. That's really funny. Cool.
Yeah. Anyway, all of this was very interesting to me. So I thought it was a fun little spelunking adventure.
Yeah, we've sort of had a series of anecdotes.
Yes.
This episode. Should we wrap?
Yes, let's wrap. Show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm/5.
As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes are appreciated.
If you have feedback on this episode or any of our other episodes, you can email us at hosts@yakshave.fm, tweet us @_yakshave, or leave a comment on the website.
Thank you for listening to The Yak Shave, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks to Shopify for sponsoring this episode of Yak Shave. Shopify is leveling the playing field for entrepreneurs, building products that help anyone with a great idea build a successful business. And they're adding to their world-class team across the globe. Visit shopify.com/careers to find out how they work.